Increasing awareness of the morbidity of long-term androgen deprivation has increased interest in the strategy of intermittent endocrine therapy, and Dr. Laurie Klotz has had a leadership role in studying this important approach. Dr. Klotz commented on our current understanding of the outcomes of this therapeutic strategy.
The interpretation of the role of intermittent therapy and of the data on intermittent therapy has been so clouded by the tremendous enthusiasm for early androgen deprivation therapy intervention in all patients with biochemical failure. And I think the question of timing of therapy early versus delayed is still very much up in the air. Studer reported at the AUA European trial, 900 patients, early versus delayed therapy, no difference in time to progression. The only patients who benefited from early therapy were patients who had a PSA doubling time less than a year, and then it's treatment prior to a PSA of 50 if they were over 70, or 20 if they were under 70. So what that tells is the vast majority of patients don't appear to benefit from early therapy, and so if you're looking at intermittent versus continuous in a cohort who don't benefit from that therapy, you're not going to see much impact. And then the optimal duration of the induction period, 9 months, not known. The correct answer is it's not known. Come back to that. This was really Whitmore's concept based on a patient. You've probably all heard the story, a competitive tennis player with metastatic disease, asymptomatic on DES, couldn't compete on the therapy, and asked Whitmore to take him off, and it led to a cohort of 20 patients at Memorial. And it just showed that you could retreat patients, they would still respond. It was pre-PSA, pre-LHRH. And then the work from Vancouver showing in the Shionogi mammary androgen-dependent model that by serially re-exposing the tumors to androgen, you could apparently reinduce androgen sensitivity. And this is in LNCAP, serial DHT, showing that this is PSA level in the animal, this is continuous, and this is serial DHT. That there's an apparent prolongation of androgen sensitivity by re-exposing the LNCAP cells to androgen. And just a comment that I'm sure this group, which is sophisticated in these matters, knows this well, but there is this paradoxical dual effect of androgens on prostate epithelium. The direct effect of androgens on prostatic epithelium is differentiation, and at some concentration, cell cycle arrest. There's an indirect effect on stroma mediated by a number of growth factors on proliferation. So you've got two phenomena, differentiation and arrest induction and proliferation. And so the idea that somehow testosterone is just a stimulator of prostate epithelial growth is not correct. And there's some other data, and I just showed one example, that this was Kiprianou, who I'm sure you know, showed a few years ago that the apoptotic effect of TGF-beta was enhanced by testosterone. So just another piece of data that re-exposure to testosterone may have an anti-proliferative or differentiation-inducing effect. This trial now goes back 15 years, and this was initiated by Nick Brokowski, who is a truly obsessive-compulsive individual. So this trial of 100 patients is now just being published for the first time, and it's been rewritten by him about 12 times. So this is actually still unpublished data. It's about 100 patients treated with 8 months of therapy, and just briefly, a couple of things that showed that the PSA lagged behind the testosterone. There's a window here, which is very predictive in terms of time to androgen-independent progression. The median time off therapy, this was biochemical failures, was 8 months after an 8-month induction. And just to show, and others have showed this as well, that the time of the off-treatment interval goes down with serial cycles. So it starts at 65% of the first total on and off-treatment cycle. By the fifth cycle, it drops to 46%. So the cycles get shorter over time. Another observation that came out of this is the baseline PSA at the time of initiation of androgen deprivation, and the median PSA in this cohort was around 10 at the time of treatment. The baseline PSA was a major predictor of the off-treatment interval. And it's interesting that the percentage of PSA response was very consistent regardless of the PSA. So the higher the baseline PSA, the higher the PSA nadir on treatment, because there was consistently about a 95% reduction, and the shorter the off-treatment interval. And then the quality of life tended to return to baseline in the off-treatment interval in all domains. And one of the controversies is the degree of testosterone recovery. And others have shown that patients who have 2 years or more of androgen deprivation have prolonged suppression of testosterone secretion, in some cases permanent. One study showed after 2 years, it takes a year for half of the patients to recover normal levels of testosterone. In this study, after 9 months of therapy, 6 months after discontinuation, the vast majority of patients had at least 50% recovery of testosterone, although about half still were less than normal. But very few of them had prolonged castrate levels. And then the issue of the equivalence in terms of time to androgen independence has been a major point of controversy. And there are about 5 international trials going on. Dave Crawford is leading one in metastatic disease. We're leading one in Canada in biochemical failure after radiation. But none of these are mature, unless Dave has something to tell us about the D2 trial. None of them are mature, except for this Portuguese trial. And this is just reported. And it's a very important contribution, I think. 630 patients with locally advanced or metastatic LHRH analog plus cypronanastate. They got 3 months of therapy as induction only. The Europeans tend to use 3 months. In the United States and Canada, it tends to be more like 8 months to a year. Retreat for PSA greater than 20. This is the only study that I know of that has mortality in the majority of its patients. A lot of studies have reported preliminary results where they show no difference, but the event rate is low. There's roughly 300 patients in each arm, so the majority have died. Of those patients dying, prostate cancer was thought to be the cause of death in most of them, about two-thirds of them in both arms. And to make a long story short, this stratifies according to PSA at randomization, no difference between intermittent and continuous. This stratifies according to metastatic status, M0 versus M1, no difference between the two arms. And this is the overall survival, absolutely no difference between the two arms with 3 months of induction. And these are patients with fairly advanced disease. So I think this is a huge support for at least the concept that the time to androgen-independent progression and prostate cancer survival is not significantly different between these two approaches of intermittent and continuous. Now, there's also no evidence of a benefit, as was postulated by some. Then some other nuances here. There's a lot of interest in prolonging the off-treatment interval with 5-alpha reductase inhibitors. This is a patient of mine, cycle 1, testosterone PSA recovery within about 6 months. This is on finasteride, and the PSA recovery is slowed pretty dramatically. And if you use PSA recovery as a trigger for retreatment, the off-treatment interval is prolonged substantially. Mark Schultz, who's in Los Angeles, reported this retrospective study of 101 patients, non-metastatic intermittent therapy compared to 60 on finasteride, 40 on no finasteride, and 31 months versus 15 months off-treatment interval. So it clearly prolongs the off-treatment interval. It allows you to reduce the amount of androgen deprivation therapy that these patients get very substantially, reduce side effects. So in addition to the Portuguese trial that I mentioned, there's the SWOG trial and D2, the intergroup. They're both intergroup trials led by SWOG, this one led by NCIC. This now has closed with 1,365 patients for PSA progression above 3 after radiation or radiation plus surgery, surgery plus radiation. The event rate in this study is half of what was anticipated. These patients are not dying fast enough for the study to report in the time frame that we anticipated. Thanks.
Thanks, Laurie. What do we know, Laurie, about the effects of finasteride on the PSA and whether or not that is just the PSA or whether it's actually affecting the tumor?
That's a good question. Well, I think the data we have is it caused a roughly a 50% reduction in PSA in patients who have BPH. And presumably it's roughly the same in prostate cancer, although that's a supposition. And I think we don't know the answer. Maybe someone here does, but whether it's affecting...
I do.
Okay, go ahead.
Dave?
We did a study with finasteride years ago for rising PSAs. Andrea and I did a couple hundred patients, but it was with 10 milligrams. And it blunted the rise of PSA for about 12 months, and then it took off. And in general, the theory is that it doesn't have much effect on established prostate cancer, although the Evidart folks believe that because of the dual inhibition, and they're doing a study with people with low-risk prostate cancer to see if the DART, what is
Redeem.
It called? Redeem.
Redeem.
Jerry?
But I thought there's no histologic evidence of an adverse effect, and there's no evidence of apoptosis from those drugs in prostate cancer cells.
There is with dutasteride.
So what's your conclusion, Jerry?
My conclusion, it's treating PSA. What I asked Laurie is, of the patients you showed in that data, how many of the patients have their prostate in place versus not? I mean, I think it's no question it's doing something to PSA, and maybe there's a benefit psychologically and from side effects by delaying the time till you go back on hormone therapy. But this idea that's being unfortunately circulated that it has an anti-cancer effect, I don't think has any foundation.
Well, we've got the PCPT data that shows us something is happening to prostate cancer.
Well, that preventing cancer is not the same thing as treating established disease. I don't think that's a fair jump.
Dan and then Len?
You also don't know what your drug target is. I mean, it could possibly be that you're targeting vascular endothelium. By withdrawing hormones, you're causing a regression of capillary endothelial cells, then causing hypoxic cell death. It may not be only a prostate cancer effect that's going on with intermittent therapy. It also could potentially be a vascular effect as well.
Mario?
We actually did a study in men with rising PSA, either androgen homo-naive or androgen independent. That was published in Urology about 3 years ago. And we found very little benefit in the hormone-naive patients. And that was with the Eli Lilly dual 5-alpha reductase inhibitor. And it showed, interestingly, that about 25% of patients with androgen-independent disease had a PSA decline. And when we mapped it out, the hormone effect, we found that it was a significant increase in estradiol level compared to the baseline.
So what do you think is going on?
Not enough to result in a testosterone reduction in homo-naive, but maybe it's a sort of an aberrant response to a functionally altered, molecularly altered androgen receptor, which is functionally active in the androgen-independent patients, such as like a PC-SPAS response that we see later on, which was interesting.
Lennon, I'm sorry.
If you believe in translational research leading to clinical trials, the data for dutasteride shows that you get apoptosis induced in radical prostatectomy specimens. You also show that you have higher levels of type 1 5-alpha reductase in prostate cancer. It appears to be upregulated in most cases of prostate cancer. So when you have a dual inhibitor, you're more likely to have a clinical effect. And I think that we can't ignore the data that's out there from PCPT that there is something going on. And we've been somewhat critical in the field of certain groups of people in this country that throw the kitchen sink at their patients, including a 5-alpha reductase inhibitor, an LHRH analog, and an anti-androgen. But there may be some rationale to it. The problem is we have to really study it. So I think we shouldn't throw it away. But we need to remember that there may be other agents out there we don't need to develop, but we just need to explore the existing ones that we have to see if they truly have an anti-cancer effect.
Craig and then Tom.
Laurie, I'm trying to see where this intermittent might fit in sort of the way we do things now. And, you know, the way I had used intermittent was sort of the low-risk patient, the one that I might put on adjuvant Casodex or Proscar. And, you know, I was wondering if you subset your data, did you find that the survival advantage was the same? I see it was for everybody, but was it better for the low-risk or worse for the high-risk?
Well, this is the Portuguese data. Yeah. So, no, the baseline parameters did not predict for a differential response intermittent versus continuous. It was basically the same independent. There were minor differences which didn't achieve any significance.
Tom?
Just to comment that the type of LHRH agonist that you use may also have an effect. There was a paper out last year showing that you can have up to 7 months where the LHRH, for instance, Lupron, remains in the system, versus a depot preparation such as Viador or Vantus, one of those, which is gone in 6 weeks. So part of the length of time that you're seeing may be a function of the LHRH agonist that you're using and the delay and washout of those agents. Secondly, it's interesting that we all multiply our PSAs by 2 when they're on a 5-alpha reductase inhibitor. It's interesting that the difference between the responses was almost exactly 2. You had 15 months versus 30 months in terms of their duration of treatment. And that may have been a function of the PSA, don't know. But it's certainly interesting to see that it's exactly half.
Steve?
I was just going to point out with the Portuguese study that you presented, they used cipriotone acetate, which we know, at least in the metastatic setting.
They used LHRH plus cipriotone acetate.
Right, so it's combined with that. But we know compared to LHRH alone actually worsens survival. You have a drug that increases mainly non prostate cancer deaths. And if you actually look at the data you presented, there was a reduction in prostate cancer deaths in the continuous arm, though there was an increase in non-prostate cancer deaths in the combined, because possibly, because they were getting more of this toxic agent, the cyproterone acetate. So I think it's difficult to extrapolate that to the way it would be treated in the United States with either intermittent maximal androgen blockade with a non-steroidal antiandrogen.
Paul? Question, Laurie. You showed that the lower the initial PSA on initiating therapy, the longer the off cycle.
Yes.
And yet the trials look for initiation of repeating the cycle at 20 plus. That seems to me to be counterproductive. I mean, it may be the trial design.
Well, the data about the PSA and the duration of the off treatment intervals from our Canadian phase 2 trial. And the PSA retreating at 20 is the Portuguese trial.
And the SWOG trials that as well. So, I mean, it seems that we're treating, from what you say, we're reinitiating the cycle maybe too late and losing the benefit of a longer off cycle as a result. I'm asking you if that makes sense.
No, I don't think we have any idea what the retreatment PSA should be. I'm very influenced by the results of this URTC trial that Erstuder has shown, showing that a PSA in the 20 to 50 range identifies patients in the high-risk group who benefit. So I think we're in the ballpark, 10, 20, 50. Less than 10 is too low. Above 50 is too high. Beyond that, I don't think we can say too much. It's just we kind of have a cultural bias against letting the PSA get up too high. But if we're being stringent, I don't think we really know whether or not that matters.
Just as a matter, with the Erstuder trial, weren't you impressed that the overall survival was better with androgen deprivation initiated early? And cancer-specific survival is a much softer endpoint. To me, it doesn't make sense that we should look hard at a survival endpoint as being superior.
In the Studer trial, there was an 11% benefit in non-prostate cancer survival in the early androgen deprivation therapy group, and no difference in prostate cancer survival. And they bent over backwards to have correct ascertainment of cause of death. So how can you explain and improve survival with early endocrine therapy? Either it's, you know, loss of testosterone means you don't drive as fast, you don't go hang gliding, which is what some people suggest, so your survival's improved, or it's just a statistical aberration because it doesn't make sense.
Tom?
But the fact is, that's the data. And that's the same argument that Ernst Studer gave, saying, well, I can't explain this, but it has to be wrong. Well, the data is the data, and we've sat here all day and we've gone back and forth, and the fact is there was a 10 to 11% difference in overall survival in favor of earlier treatment. Some of us don't like that finding. I'm not thrilled about it, but nonetheless, that's the finding, and I don't think we can say we can just poo-poo it because it doesn't suit what we want to do. It's there, and it has to be recognized, and he didn't recognize it, and you know, I was surprised that he didn't, because it is a difference.
Well, I think you could question... You could say the ascertainment of cause of death can never be 100%. Therefore, maybe actually there is a benefit in terms of prostate cancer survival. He would dispute that aggressively. Or you could say that they actually showed a non-prostate cancer survival benefit. It's actually healthy to be on LHRH analogs. And that I would just reject because it flies in the face of so much other data that we know about the toxic. It just, sometimes you can reject results that just don't make sense, and that's one of them.
Well, it does answer our question about the cardiac side effects, because if there were significant cardiac side effects, one would surely have expected to see more death rates in the earlier treated patients because they've been on it for longer.